Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios.
It's Wednesday, August 19th.
We'll begin today with a few excerpts from the Democratic Convention speeches last night, and we'll get some thoughts about them from Washington Post columnist Jonathan Capehart and from you on the phones. My own opinion, I thought the DNC did very well in general with their production values last night. I love the roll call of the 50 states delegations with actual video from all the states and territories, and I thought it humanized the presenters more, too. I'll be very interested to see next week if the Republicans try to do their version of the same thing or if they try to go more live somehow, because President Trump has been deriding the Democrats' pre-tape format. So that'll be an interesting contrast next week. Jill Biden's job last night was mostly to draw distinctions between the personal character of her husband and Donald Trump, without even saying Donald Trump. And she did it in part with her own story of becoming a stepmom after Joe's first wife died.
You know, motherhood came to me in a way I never expected. I fell in love with a man and two little boys standing in the wreckage of unthinkable loss, mourning a wife and mother, a daughter and sister. I never imagined at the age of 26 I would be asking myself, how do you make a broken family whole? Still, Joe always told the boys, Mommy sent Jill to us, and how could I argue with her?
Jill Biden. Another goal of the convention last night was to argue that the Democrats care about your health care and President Trump doesn't. Now, Democrats generally have an advantage on health care, but the contrast is even more stark right now, obviously because of the pandemic and the president's response to the pandemic. A lot of people are talking about the speech last night by healthcare activist Adi Barkin, who spoke through a speech-generating device because he lost his own voice box to ALS.
Even during this terrible crisis, Donald Trump and Republican politicians are trying to take away millions of people's health insurance. With the existential threat of another 4 years of this president, we all have a profound obligation to act. Not only to vote, but to make sure that our friends, family, and neighbors vote as well.
Adi Barkin. Another main theme last night was America's place in the world, and probably most effective in that realm, least to my ear, was the former Joint Chiefs of Staff chairman under the first President Bush and Secretary of State under the second President Bush, a hero, especially to many older Americans of both parties. I will let him introduce himself.
Hi, I'm former Secretary of State Colin Powell. 100 years ago, a young immigrant left a dirt farm in Jamaica and set out for America. 3 years later, a ship pulled into New York Harbor and a young Jamaican woman gazed up at the Statue of Liberty for the first time. They became my parents, and they inspired me to finish college and join the Army. This began a journey of service that would take me from basic training to combat in Vietnam, up the ranks to serve as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and Secretary of State. The values I learned growing up in the South Bronx and serving in uniform were the same values that Joe Biden's parents instilled in him in Scranton, Pennsylvania. I support Joe Biden for the presidency of the United States because those values still define him, and we need to restore those values to the White House. Our country needs a commander-in-chief who takes care of our troops in the same way he would his own family. For Joe Biden, that doesn't need teaching. It comes from the experience he shares with millions of military families, sending his beloved son off to war and praying to God he would come home safe.
So that was about foreign policy on one level, again, about Joe Biden's character, and without saying the other guy on the other. So there was a Republican from the Bronx, General Colin Powell, popular with older Americans. And there was also the most famous progressive from the Bronx these days, popular with younger Americans, Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And for all the chatter beforehand about how she was only being given a minute of speaking time, I thought this felt substantial when it happened. A minute and a half, exactly, as it turned out. Still very short. But whether you're a fan or not, she definitely commands your attention and makes you think about what she says.
Good evening, bienvenidos, and thank you to everyone here today endeavoring towards a better, more just future for our country and our world. In fidelity and gratitude to a mass people's movement working to establish 21st century social, economic, and human rights, including guaranteed health care, higher education, living wages, and labor rights for all people in the United States. A movement striving to recognize and repair the wounds of racial injustice, colonization, misogyny, and homophobia, and to propose and build reimagined systems of immigration and foreign policy that turn away from the violence and xenophobia of our past. A movement that realizes the unsustainable brutality of an economy that rewards explosive inequalities of wealth for the few at the expense of long-term stability for the many, and who organized a historic grassroots campaign to reclaim our democracy. In a time when millions of people in the United States are looking for deep, systemic solutions to our crises of mass evictions, unemployment, and lack of health care, in el espíritu del pueblo and out of a love for all people, I hereby second the nomination of Senator Bernard Sanders of Vermont for President of the United States of America.
AOC, last night, those were her complete remarks. And a relevant context for her and her supporters doing that seconding speech for Bernie Sanders. If you're wondering, by the way, why that even happened, Sanders' name got put into nomination because he won delegates in the primaries around the country. And if you watched last night, you heard those delegates being counted by number in the state-by-state roll call. The person who was chosen to put Joe Biden's name into nomination as part of literally elevating the voices of essential workers was a New York City elevator operator named Jacqueline Brittany, who became a fan of Biden when she carried him up to a meeting in the building of the New York Times.
I take powerful people up on my elevator all the time. When they get off, they go to their important meetings. Me, I just head back to the lobby. But in the short time I spent with Joe Biden, I could tell he really saw me, that he actually cared, that my life meant something to him. And I knew, even when he went into his important meeting, he'd take my story in there with him. That's because Joe Biden has room in his heart for more than just himself. We've been through a lot, and we have tough days ahead. But nominating someone like that to be in the White House is a good place to start. That's why I nominate my friend, Joe Biden, as the next president of the United States.
Jacqueline Brittany nominating Joe Biden. And with me now is Washington Post columnist Jonathan Capehart, also host of the podcast Cape Up. Hi, Jonathan. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning, Brian. Thanks for having me back.
And I saw that you tweeted about Jacqueline Brittany, the elevator operator who put Biden's name into formal nomination. You liked that choice?
Oh, it was terrific. Terrific because, as you heard, I'm glad you played. I don't know if it was the entirety of her speech,
but the clip
that you played. I mean, here's this person who never expected that someone in a position of power would not only talk to her, but actually see her. It speaks to just the humanity, the empathy, the compassion of Joe Biden. And it stands in stark relief to the man who's in the White House now. And that is exactly why she was chosen to speak, to highlight that clear difference, that clear divide between President Trump and former Vice President Biden. And I think coming a day after the other phenomenal emotional speech, and I'm sure you talked about it yesterday, Kristen Urquiza, mm-hmm. who lost her father to COVID, who is a Trump, her father is a Trump supporter, and the key devastating line where she said, my father was a healthy 65-year-old. His only pre-existing condition was trusting Donald Trump. Devastating testimony, devastating witness against the president. And so to have her followed by Jacqueline Britney, followed by whoever is going to be the breakout, standout, everyday person tonight and then Thursday night, it's setting up an incredible case, empathetic, human case, not just a policy case, but a human case against President Trump.
Let's take a phone call. Ian in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, wants to react to the presence of Colin Powell, and we played that clip, part of that speech that he gave last night at the Democratic Convention. Ian, you're on WNYC. Thanks so much for calling in.
Hey, Brian. Thanks. It's great to talk to you. You're doing really wonderful work for us. You know, Colin Powell is a war criminal responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people. And I think that the Democrats, in effect, having the first week of the Republican convention on their own is not what we need right now. Obama's quote-unquote bipartisanship was an attempt to appease the Republican right wing, and that's what brought us Trump. And the Democrats doing the same thing with having speakers like Colin Powell at their convention is going to be a failed attempt at appeasement again. And I'm not down for it, so I have not been convinced. I am still abstaining. Not interested in a Republican light. Not interested at all.
Ian, thank you very much. Well, a couple of things about that, Jonathan. One, there are still some people out there, and we see it in some of the polls. We talked about this with another guest on yesterday's show, on Monday's show, who are undecided between voting for Democrats and not voting because they see it like that caller as Republican light even now. And then there's also the question of General Powell's place in history. And I think he, you know, has said that he felt duped into supporting the Iraq war by phony intelligence that he got before he made a famous presentation before the war at the UN. But I don't know. How do you see Colin Powell's place in history and to whatever, to the other argument that the caller was making about Republican light?
I'll start with Colin Powell's place in history. Look, if we've learned anything through the Trump presidency, is that history is complicated, and the people who make the history are complicated. And the indictment that Ian leveled against former Secretary of State Colin Powell, you know, I understand where he's coming from, and I know what the argument is, and that's something that history will deal with when it comes to assessing the legacy, the true legacy of Secretary Powell. But I have to take issue with this notion that the Democratic Party is Republican light. After everything that we have seen over the last 3.5 years, or you want to say 5 years since the onset of Donald Trump in American politics, to say that you are undecided or that you are abstaining from this election is, and I know I'm going to get in trouble for this, it's highly irresponsible. To not vote in this election is to vote for Donald Trump. If you care about the direction of this country, about American democracy, about democracy writ large around the world, about the small d democratic principles and ideals that have held the international order together for more than 70 years, if you care about the people in the streets protesting for Black lives, protesting against racism, protesting against a president who unleashed federal troops on American citizens on live television and continues to do so around the country, if you truly care about what is happening right now as we speak in the streets in this country, and you want to be in a position to stop it, then not voting is not the way to go. Looking at the Democratic Party as nothing but, quote, Republican light is foolish. We have been saying since the 2000 election or 2004 election, this is the most important presidential race of our lifetimes. Well, the 2020 presidential race, I hope, will be the last most important presidential race in our lifetimes, because if Joe Biden and the Democratic Party does not win the White House in 2020 on November 3rd, then American democracy, democracy around the world, America as we know it, the America that Ian lives in and that I live in, and we're different ends of the Democratic spectrum, excuse me, that America will disappear. We're always like shocked and aghast 3.5 years into the Trump administration by what he does, what he says, and then what he does. Imagine a reelected President Trump and what he would do and would be able to do with a second term. And then, sure, you know, the reason why Colin Powell and these Republicans who we've now seen over the last two nights have been asked to speak, it is not to appeal to Democrats. It is to appeal to those Republicans of conscience who may have voted for Donald Trump for other reasons, but who are embarrassed by the man they put into the White House with their vote, and to give them an opportunity and to say, through Colin Powell, through John Kasich, through Cindy McCain, that Joe Biden is the person who is going to save the country from this man.
Let's take another call. I think Charles in Manhattan wants to comment on AOC's appearance last night. Charles, you're on WNYC with Jonathan Capehart from The Washington Post. Hi there.
Thank you so much, Brian. I just wanted to say that the congresswoman that spoke last night from the Bronx, a lot of people just in general aren't very smart. And I can learn a few things. But anytime you end your speech with another candidate like Bernie Sanders, you throw them a curve. You know, they want to hear Joe Biden. And it's almost like something's being forced down your throat. And that's basically all I wanted to say.
Thank you very much. I get your point. And, you know, Jonathan, I was watching the AOC part while talking on the phone with a friend watching the convention at their place. This is what you do in the age of physical distancing, right? You don't get together to watch the convention. Let's talk on the phone together while watching the convention in our own places. But when AOC ended her speech, and I knew because of what I do for a living that she was there to help put Bernie's name into nomination. But when she ended her speech by saying, "That's why I'm seconding the nomination of Bernie Sanders," my friend was like, "What? Is she there as a voice of dissent against Joe Biden like this caller was?" How do you think that came off?
It was a little bit jarring. But again, like you, I know the reason why she was there to second Bernie Sanders' nomination. Excuse me. But I saw it as her laying down a marker by saying, you know, right now we are behind the Biden-Harris ticket. And Bernie was our guy, and he stood for all these things, and I'm here to second his nomination, but I'm here as a part of this convention for Biden and Harris to support that ticket. But if/when there is a Biden-Harris administration, I will be right here with Senator Sanders to not only hold the Biden-Harris administration accountable for fixing a lot of the problems, but to also be there to push a Biden-Harris administration on policy in a variety of areas. And actually, that is a good thing, because we are going to need as much, as a country, as much energy and ideas to solve the problems, the myriad problems that this country has that have gone ignored because of the current administration's insular focus from the president on down.
And I saw that Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez clarified why that came out the way it did in an Instagram story last night, the same thing we've been clarifying here, but I guess she felt the need to say, here's the context, folks, on Instagram, and she's got like 6 million Instagram followers, so a lot of people would have seen that, and her followers probably already want her to hold the Biden administration's feet to the fire in the way you were just describing, assuming Biden gets elected. You know, Jonathan, not to do a buzzkill for Democrats feeling all warm and fuzzy after last night, but remember, this is a competition between the two parties. Nothing goes unanswered. And so here is a 30-second taste of what we'll probably hear long form from the Republicans next week as former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee reacted to last night's DNC presentations in the 11 p.m. hour on Fox.
If America was electing somebody to be nice, they would elect Jill Biden. She would be the better Biden to be on the ballot. But that's not what this is about. This is about very serious policies that determine the future of our country. So if you like the idea of open borders, bigger taxes, more statism, government control of your lives, abortion funded by the taxpayers, if you like us surrendering to China at every turn so the multinational corporations will be happy and keep putting backsheesh in the hands of politicians, then the Democrats are your choice. That's what you should do.
Mike Huckabee on Fox last night with kind of a Republican response. Obviously, we'll be hearing Democratic responses to the Republican convention next week. But Jonathan Capehart, game this out for us a little bit. What's the compare and contrast messages you think people will be coming away with after the full 2 weeks of this?
Well, I'm glad you played a former governor, Huckabee, and what he said, because that he sort of articulated what I said at the beginning of our conversation, that everything he said there, you know, politically, I can understand. A lot of it is rooted in, you know, conservative ideology. But it's all rooted in fear and loathing. And I think if that is sort of a taste of what we're going to see next week, then after 4 days of fear and loathing, I'm not sure an America that has been cooped up inside since March or late February, depending on when your particular city or state decided to lock down, and a country that is worried about the future, both in terms of the pandemic, but the economy and just society, the American people are scared. And when people are scared and frightened, they are always looking for the light at the end of the tunnel. And what we're seeing over these 4 days is a recognition of that fear, but also people pointing to the light at the end of the tunnel. And that Mike Huckabee clip that you just played is nothing but fear. There's no light at the end of the tunnel. There's no conversation, at least in that Mike Huckabee clip, about how we get past this point together as a nation that doesn't rely on racism, doesn't rely on xenophobia, doesn't rely on misogyny, doesn't rely on us versus them, but is emphasized by we the people. And by the end of next week, I hope that the choice is extra clear, and that that both parties make their case, and that the obvious choice for the American people will be made clear.
So I know you got to go in a minute. Tonight, Barack Obama speaks, Kamala Harris speaks. You wrote a column called Why Biden's Elevation of Kamala Harris Puts a Lump in My Throat. I see someone who reflects the work twice as hard values I was raised with and the tightrope demeanor demanded of a black person navigating white spaces that I have had to learn, you wrote. Want to elaborate on that a little bit before you go to set up tonight?
You know, representation matters, and I know there are people on the right who think that's squishy and being quote-unquote politically correct and maybe even snowflakey. But when you're a person of color or a member of a marginalized community where you are not used to seeing people who either look like you or reflect your life as you live it, to see someone who does in a position of either public, in the public eye, or in a position of power, it is breathtaking, and it can be overwhelming. But it's also something that makes you incredibly proud, not just of that person, but of yourself and what you've done and what you've been able to accomplish. It's a validation of who you are as a person and as a community. And so for Kamala Harris, this daughter of immigrants, who to rise up from her own family's humble beginnings, which is a quintessential American story, to rise to the position that she's in right now and to rise to a position of power that I and millions of other people hope she and Joe Biden rise to, is something that is, it is awe-inspiring, and it is something that I think, again, to my last answer, to look at Biden and Harris, but especially Harris in this moment, they are the light at the end of the tunnel.
Washington Post columnist Jonathan Capehart, also host of the podcast Cape Up. Jonathan, always appreciate it. Thanks a lot for your time today.
Great. Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at wnyc.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.